Professor Jeremy Black is a historian with wide-ranging interests. Among other subjects of interest, he has thoughtfully unraveled the special and peculiar relationship between the United States and Great Britain. He's a professor of history, as I mentioned, at the University of Exeter, and a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of America and the West at the Foreign Policy Relations Institute. Jeremy Black is a prolific writer. He's the author of over 100 books, which I am told is a world record for single-authored works by a historian. This is a remarkable feat for anyone, but for someone still in the middle of his career, it's truly remarkable. We were joking on the way over that he must have written a book on the airplane just to and from here. His books range in topics from politics in the 18th century to military history to historical methodology. Recent publications include The Battle of Waterloo, Great Powers and the Quest for Hegemony, The World Order Since 1500, and Crisis of Empire, Britain and America in the 18th Century. Dr. Black graduated from Queen's College, Cambridge, with a starred first. Now, for the Americans here, you just need to know that that's a very rare accomplishment. He then went on and did postgraduate work at St. John's and Merton's Colleges in Oxford, and finished his PhD, which began in Oxford, at the University of Durham, where he was offered a teaching post at the age of 25. He stayed at Durham until 1996, when the University of Exeter lured him away with the offer of an endowed chair in history, and there he remains. Jeremy Black has lectured extensively throughout the world. The Society of Military History awarded him the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for Lifetime Achievement in 2008. He was made a member of the Royal Society of Arts and appointed a member of the British Empire for services to stamp design. Now, please join me in welcoming to campus Professor Jeremy Black.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed the anniversary of Yorktown, and it is worth bearing in mind that I am talking about could the British have won, not should the British have won. And indeed, before I come to those points, I'd like to make one or two preparatory remarks. When one looks at the past and asks, could a different outcome have occurred, what one is doing is not, if one has intelligence, saying one regrets what happened. What one is trying to do is throw light on the achievements of the people involved. And in my view, the standard account of the American Revolution underplays the achievements of those Americans who fought against the British Empire. Indeed, the standard account is rather one that makes it inevitable that the Americans would have won. You know, if you think of the standard visual image, you have a sun-kissed meadow. And on one side of this sun-kissed meadow, you have lines of musketeers slowly moving forward in their red coats. And on the other side of the meadow, crouching beside stone walls and trees, you have brave patriots clad in brown and green, and they are about to blast these idiots to pieces. And that is the that is the standard image, and it's an image which underplays what actually happened. And the point of my lecture, what I intend to do, is to focus first on the strengths of the British Empire and British state in 1775. I then intend to focus on some of the particular difficulties facing the Americans, and then I want to look at this question at the end of could the British have won? And my central theme, and I always believe it's important at the outset to give the central theme, my central theme is that the efforts of those individuals and groups involved made a tremendous difference, that there was nothing foreordained about the victory of the Patriots. And in a sense, because I believe historians should always, when they look at the past, think about the relevance of what they are saying for the present, the relevance is this, is quite simply one which I imagine would cause no surprise to anybody here, because this is an institution that prides itself on dedication and service, that people do make a difference. And let me start with an obvious instance from the 18th century in which the individuals made a difference, and that is the British state faced four rebellions in the 18th century. The only one that succeeded was the American War of Independence. The Jacobite Rising in Scotland and Northern England of 1715 to 16 failed. The Jacobite Rising in Scotland and Northern England of 1745 to 46 failed. The Irish Rising in 1798 failed. In other words, the British state, on the whole, was successful in counterinsurgency warfare. And indeed, some of the very individuals who were involved in the American War of Independence on the British side fought in these other struggles. Cornwallis, the general who surrendered at Yorktown in 1781, was the commander-in-chief in Ireland in 1798. The British minister, Lord George Germain, who was Secretary of State for the colonies in the 1770s and directed British military policy in North America, had actually, as a young man, been an army officer in Scotland suppressing the Jacobite Rising. So the British state was experienced in counterinsurgency warfare. Second, Britain had the tremendous advantage in the period 1775 to 1782 that Britain was the largest naval power in the world, had the biggest navy, and was therefore able to project its power across the Atlantic with very little difficulty. During the war, there were, of course, American privateers, American ships that attacked British shipping in the Atlantic. But less than 2% of the British ships crossing the Atlantic were actually captured by the Americans, and at no stage did the Americans win a squadron action, let alone a fleet action, of any size against the British Navy in Atlantic waters, which meant that the British could choose where to attack America and whether to attack America. And this advantage was taken even further in North America because there were three British naval bases in the New World, and none of them were involved in the revolution. The British naval bases were at Halifax, Nova Scotia, Kingston, Jamaica, and English Island in Antigua. And that serves as a reminder that half of the British colonies in the New World did not rise in rebellion in 1775. Had the whole of the British world of the New World risen in rebellion, then the British really would have faced a possibly insuperable problem. But instead, the British had secure bases to the north of the 13 colonies in Canada and secure bases to the south of the 13 colonies in the Floridas and the West Indies. And these bases enabled them to choose when to act against the 13 colonies. So that, for example, in 1776, after the British withdrew from Boston in March, they were able to recuperate, take on resupplies at Halifax, and then pop up at Staten Island that summer. Linked to this point is other advantages the British had in operating in North America. The British, of course, firstly, were well experienced at operating in North America. During what you call the French and Indian War and what we call the Seven Years' War, the British had conquered Canada between 1758 and 1760. So British officers, British troops were experienced at operating there, and the actual task of operating in Canada in some respects was logistically much harder than operating in the 13 colonies. Another point which helped the British enormously is that you have to rethink the geography of America. At the present moment, America is a state, a continent in many sense, pretending to be a country, that spans from ocean to ocean. But in 1775, 75% of the population of the 13 colonies lived within 75 miles of the coast. In other words, America was primarily a coastal series of colonies, and indeed it was also profoundly urban. The nearest comparison in the modern world, for those of you who've travelled, is Australia, as you may know. Australians like to present themselves as people from the outback, but the majority of Australians today live in large cities such as Sydney and Melbourne and Perth. Well, the same is true in America in 1775. Those people who counted lived in port cities. Boston, Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, Savannah were the principal cities. Those were the political centres of the 13 colonies. Those were the economic centres. And they were peculiarly vulnerable to naval power. They were even further vulnerable to naval power because of the nature of the geography of America on its eastern seaboard. Whereas on the western seaboard of America, the bodies of water do not penetrate far into the interior. On the eastern seaboard, Long Island Sound, the Chesapeake, the Delaware, penetrated quite far into the interior of major areas of settlement. British ocean-going ships could sail as far up the Hudson as Albany. So in practical terms, this was an area vulnerable to naval power. The vulnerability was increased by the fact that obviously there was no comparison to the interstates. Most trade within the 13 colonies moved by sea. To cross the big waterways, you had to use ferries. This was an area that was particularly vulnerable to naval power. On top of that, three other immediate factors that one will note helping the British are, number one, that Britain was domestically stable. The country had last faced a general election in 1774. The government had won it. The government was securely in control of Parliament. Under the law, it didn't need to face another general election till 1781. They had a septennial act system. You had to have a Parliament elections at least every 7 years. They held it perfectly legally a year early in 1780, and they won that general election. So the government is facing domestic stability at home. Second, until 1778, Britain is not at war with anybody else in the world. So the British in 75, 76, and 77 are able to focus their military efforts on the 13 colonies. On top of that, they are helped by the fact that in North America, they have significant allies within the 13 colonies itself. Much of the Native American population actually fights for the British, and that makes quite a difference in areas like Western New York State and Western Pennsylvania. On top of that, the war is a civil war within the 13 colonies. There are large numbers of loyalists, and the importance of the loyalists is increased by the fact that they live in geographically concentrated areas. So that just as most of the population of New England and of Virginia are patriots, so much of the population of Georgia, large parts of upcountry North Carolina, large parts of New Jersey, large parts of the Hudson Valley and of Long Island are patriots. And these patriots are quite willing to die for their vision of America, just as these loyalists are quite ready to die for their vision of North America, just as the patriots are. The last point, before I start to turn to some of the difficulties facing the Americans, is the actual military means itself was not too difficult for the British. The war, in some respects, was as conventional as it was revolutionary. One obvious form of conventionality was that there was no major new weapon system. There was a potential weapon system, and it was, of course, invented by an American, the first workable submarine. And if the submarine had actually been effective, it would have had devastating effects on the British, because the British had no protected anchorages. But the submarine could be described, if you look at me, I'm rather plump. If you think of myself, twice my circumference as a wooden barrel, caulked with pitch to stop water coming in. This barrel with a man inside it, powered by a bicycle mechanism, so the chap inside moves his legs up and down, and that drives pedals at the back. And the submarine is armed, which is semi-submersible. The top, obviously, has to be above water level, because there's no way of producing stored air in that period. And the submarine is armed with the equivalent of a giant corkscrew, so that inside you turn this device, which at the outside attaches a mine to the underside of a wooden warship. Now, you will understand that when HMS Eagle saw this thing coming towards it in New York Harbour in 1776, it was readily able to take avoiding action. So the submarine doesn't make a difference. Incidentally, Americans go on to play a major role, particularly a chap called Robert Fulton, in designing submarine technology in the 18th century, because into the early 19th century, because at every stage they are looking at ways to counter British naval strength. But apart from the submarine, the weapons that are used are fundamentally ones that the British are well used to. Both sides are armed with equivalent weapons. The Americans, of course, make some use of rifles, But rifles, although they're excellent for sniping, and they are used with some deadly effect around Saratoga, rifles are not a very good battlefield weapon because they don't carry bayonets. And if you've got people charging towards you, if you're a rifleman, you've got people charging towards you with muskets with bayonets on the end of it, the thing you do is fire a volley and then run away. And in practical terms, most American soldiers were armed with muskets, exactly the same as their British counterparts. Another point which helps the British is that the American leadership initially chooses, and largely keeps with its choice, other than in the South, initially chooses to fight in methods that are very similar to those used by the British. Essentially, two different strategies are offered to the Americans in 1775-6 by their military leaders. The strategy that is followed is that outlined by George Washington, the commander of the Continental Army, that's the Army of the Continental Congress, and this is a strategy essentially which is exactly what the British want. What Washington argues is in favour of what is known as position warfare. He argues that it is necessary to hold the major cities, because without holding the major cities, America will not be able to trade with the outside world and will not be seen by the outside world as an independent state. And that in order to hold these cities, it is necessary to deploy troops in regular order to contest British advances. So, for example, the Americans fight the British in the Battle of Long Island in 1776 to try and stop the British capturing New York, and they do exactly the same in 1777 at Brandywine to try and stop the British capturing Philadelphia. And in each case, they fail, because not surprisingly, they are doing exactly what the British want them to do, which is, instead of fading away into the enormity of America, they are actually putting themselves in harm's way. The alternative strategy was outlined by Major General Charles Lee, one of the more impressive of the American commanders, who actually argues against Washington that what the Americans should do is they should, in a sense, avoid position warfare. They should melt away when the British advance. They should then harry their supply lines, harry and attack small detachments of British forces, and operate at what they called a kind of guerrilla, or their term, bandit warfare. And had they done so, and in many senses that's what the Americans switched to doing in the South in 1781, it would have made it very difficult for the British. But at least initially, the Americans are fighting in a way that again helps the British. So these are all advantages the British have. They don't exhaust the list. There are others one can come to, but in the time available, those are the ones that are most important. What about the disadvantages facing the Americans? Well, some of the disadvantages are obviously the corresponding points I've just made, but there are other elements as well. First, the Revolution begins as a movement for freedom against authoritarian rule. Well, that's very fine if it's directed against the British state on the other side of the Atlantic and the British Crown. But of course, if you are actually holding a revolution in which you don't want to pay taxes which you don't agree with, and that you don't want to, as it were, accept the restrictions that comes of being part of a big imperial system, it's not surprising that many American patriots also were pretty unwilling to support efforts on their behalf by patriots in other states. Indeed, if you look at the correspondence of George Washington, and you can look at the originals, but they've been published in a marvellous series for the Revolutionary War years by the University of Virginia Press, and I'm sure it's in the library here. If you look at those volumes, you will find that Washington's correspondence is full of complaints about people being unwilling to serve in the army, about people being unwilling to provide money for the military, and about people being unwilling to sell supplies to the military. The first year was the year in which most Americans served against the British, 1775. By 1781, large-scale desertion is so great that you see two major mutinies in both the Pennsylvania line and the New Jersey line of unwillingness to serve. So in other words, there's a tension between the fact that most Americans in 75 signed up for a short war designed to, as it were, punch King George on the nose and then hoping that there would be a political settlement. It's very interesting that it takes a while to move to independence. As late as the spring of 76, they hoped that the demonstration, many people hoped, that the demonstration of a willingness to fight would lead the British to offer good terms. What the Americans had not signed up for is what happened in 1776, which is the Empire Strikes Back. In other words, the dispatch of a large-scale expeditionary force, which, of course, it is impossible to really do very much about. If you think about it, the Americans have this enormous problem during the war that all they can do is defeat British forces. What they cannot do is to force Britain to stop fighting, because the Americans do not have the strength or the power projection to invade Britain and to knock Britain out of the war. And that is a real challenge, and it's a challenge that gets worse as the war continues, because fiscal strain increases, economic exhaustion increases. It's a very good book by the American scholar Harold Solensky on Connecticut during the war. Connecticut was the breadbasket state for the middle colonies. Most of the grain for the Continental Army comes out of Connecticut. And Solensky's point in this book is that by 1780, and even more 1781, the economy of Connecticut is completely exhausted. There's nothing more to give. The strain is intense. And this is not really surprising. Although the 13 colonies are economically quite productive, one of the problems of being at war with Britain is they've lost their biggest market, they've lost their major source of credit, and they're up against a world empire which is running much of the trade of the Western world. This makes it very, very difficult to prevail. So there are powerful factors making it hard for the Americans. There is also the difficulty of seeing, and indeed this is also true for the British, but there's the difficulty for the Americans of seeing their way out of the struggle. You might fight for independence, but what precisely do you do if the other side won't give up, if the other side holds major positions in your territory? Even after Yorktown, for example, the British are still in control of New York, they're still in control of Savannah, they're still in control of Charleston. In 1782, which is the year of the war which almost everybody ignores, George Washington's great plan is, having beaten Cornwallis's army at Yorktown, he's going to drive the British out of New York City. Just doesn't happen. So in other words, the Americans know that any peace treaty is going to have to be a compromise peace, just as they failed to conquer Canada. There's going to be a partition of North America, the terms of the British North America. The terms of that partition are difficult. But one of the challenges for the Americans is, how do you move from the output of, in a sense, which is the standard thing in military activity? Output is you kill your opponents in battle, you capture pieces of territory. But how do you move from output to outcome, to the result of a peace treaty in which you achieve your goals or most of your goals? And it was very difficult to conceptualize that, not least because it was difficult to see where a compromise was going to come from. That point about where a compromise is going to come from then raises attention to the third issue. Could the outcome have been different? Well, there are several different ways of looking at it. A number of prominent American patriots argued that once fighting had started, there was going to be no stop other than complete victory. Benjamin Franklin remarked that once the British had started to make war on Americans, were setting fire, by which he meant naval bombardments, to American towns, once that was happening, that there was no way they were ever going to treat with the British. John Adams famously remarked that the revolution was won in men's hearts and minds before the fighting even started. And if you take that point of view, then you could argue that the result was a foreordained conclusion, that it was bound to happen, and that the British might as well have given up at the outset. And indeed, that argument can be made. But of course, that doesn't actually capture the reality on the ground, nor does it help explain why the British were fighting. The reality on the ground is, of course, there were people willing to deal with the British, not least the large chunk of the population who were loyalists. And in many senses, British strategy was a question of strengthening the loyalists and moving as far as possible the neutrals. And there are many people who didn't want to back either side, moving as far as possible the neutrals to back the loyalists and the patriots to become neutral. And let me give you an example of that. South Carolina. In 1780, the British advance on South Carolina. They've captured and held Savannah. They're now advancing along the coastline in an amphibious operation. Using their ships very effectively, they cross all the rivers round Charleston, the Ashley and the Cooper, and they blockade the city. The city fathers of Charleston say that they will never deal with the British. Benjamin Lincoln, the commander-in-chief in the south, who is holed up in Charleston with a large army, 5,000 men, which is a large army for the Patriots, says, we will never deal with the British. We will fight to the end. Then the British, the swines, start firing red-hot shot into the city. That's shot that has been preheated so that it actually sets fire to buildings. Whereupon the city fathers say to Lincoln, we have got to surrender, whereupon Lincoln surrenders. Now, what then happens is rather interesting. The city fathers of Charleston return to their loyalty. They don't just surrender, they agree to accept the resumption of civil government in South Carolina, civil government in which they are going to take a role. So having said they will never negotiate, they immediately begin negotiating the terms of a return to royal power. And indeed, British strategy in the South in 1780, 1781, is based on the idea that you could progressively encourage the most sympathetic areas to deal with you, to have a return to British authority, and then in the end you were going to have to deal with those areas that you thought were not going to do so. And there was a kind of domino strategy they were trying. First of all, start with Georgia, because Florida never rebelled. First of all, start with Georgia, then move on to South Carolina, then move on to North Carolina. Of course, it didn't work in the end, but what is interesting is that they thought it could work. Next point, linked to that, and indeed, looking at the South, you can go to the National Archives in London, used to be called the Public Record Office. It's now in Kew, in a sort of space-age building. And in there you can read a set of correspondence called Headquarters Correspondence, which is the correspondence in 1781 between Cornwallis, who's then Commander-in-Chief in the South, the man who surrenders at Yorktown, and the British Commander-in-Chief in North America as a whole, a chap called General Sir Henry Clinton, no relation to the President. And Cornwallis and Clinton hate each other, and what Cornwallis is doing is writing a set of letters to Clinton explaining why he can't do better and putting all the blame on factors outside his control. And what he argues is that the natives are all hostile, the area is enormous, he's short of food, he's short of supplies, his couriers are getting murdered, send help or you can't really expect anything better. And you can look at those papers have been quoted by a number of historians, and you could say, well, it's inevitable, the British could never have done it, just close the book and move on. Well, you can also go to the Manuscript Division of the Library of Congress, and in the Manuscript Division of the Library of Congress is a set of correspondence from General Nathaniel Greene to George Washington. Nathaniel Greene, a highly talented American, a Quaker, quartermaster general of the Continental Army, is sent down to command in the South after Benjamin Lincoln has been sacked for doing disgracefully, and then his successor, Horatio Gates, has been sacked for also doing disgracefully and losing. And Greene goes down in 81, and the letters have since been published by the University of North Carolina Press, but when I read them, I had to read the originals. And you can look at these, and what is he writing back? The locals are all hostile. I am short of troops. I am short of food. I am short of supplies. My couriers are being murdered. Send help, otherwise you can't expect very much. So in other words, what you have is two generals saying essentially the same thing. Now, in one respect, this shouldn't surprise you. Let me tell you, there are very few generals in military history that actually write reports home saying, I have got everything that I want. Success is assured. Don't worry. There are what, you know... MacArthur in a period in 1950 was a bit like that, but that's an unusual thing to be. So in a way, you know, for the historian, and history is about judging sources, the classic thing you learn from this is to put both sets of sources against each other, always look over the hill at what the other side is thinking, and then stop to think. And what you stop and think about is, of course, as both sides know that the situation is as it were, out of control, so the impact of short-term factors, of the decisions of the individuals involved, those factors grow in importance. And indeed, by 1781, both sides know and think that they are in a high-risk situation in which neither side is confident of success. From the American point of view, after all, the Americans are now in a world war against the British, but the world war isn't going as well as it should have been. France comes into the war alongside the Americans in 1778, Spain in 1779, and the Dutch enter the war in the end of 1780. But the French and the Spaniards had jointly tried a knockout invasion blow of England in 1779. Indeed, what the Americans would have liked to do had they had the wherewithal, and it had been a dismal failure. Britain, in other words, is still able to go on fighting, which is a real challenge for the Americans. Equally, the British aren't winning. By the spring of 1781, it's not clear to the British how they are going to get out of this. So why, you might ask, do the British go on trying to fight? Well, the British are going on trying to fight because they have completely and utterly misunderstood the situation in a quite fundamental way. They assume that if America becomes independent, America, once it is independent, will always ally with France and Spain against Britain. So that, in other words, the British, in many senses, are fighting in the Carolinas and Virginia in order to save the British Empire from the French, which, of course, is actually not what happens. When America becomes independent, it doesn't actually ally with the French. But that is why both sides are going on, neither fully understanding the situation that they are in, neither believing that it is a foregone conclusion. So let me ask the question. We started off being told it is the anniversary of Yorktown. Let me ask the question. What would have happened if different events had occurred, if Yorktown had worked out differently? Because Yorktown could easily have worked out differently. There had been a similar episode to Yorktown in 1778, when the British had withdrew from Philadelphia, marched across New Jersey, fought George Washington at Monmouth Courthouse, and then ended up on the New Jersey shore in an exposed position, not too different to their position at Yorktown in 1781. And of course, all they'd done is they'd got onto ships which had come over from New York and sailed back. In 1781, if the British had been able to maintain their control of the Chesapeake, Cornwallis would just have sailed away. Now, does this mean, in a way, that the results could have been different? Can you conceptualize an American War of Independence in which either because of British victories earlier on, or because of much more sweeping American victories, you could have had a different outcome. Let us say an outcome in which Canada became American, in which British North America, all of it became American, with all the differences that that would have made for American history. I think that this is unlikely. I think that it was always the case that a compromise of some type was going to have to be the case, partly because it was indeed in the 18th century harder than many people liked to allow to force people against their will to return to their loyalty. Not impossible, it could happen, and I gave you examples like Ireland in 1798, but nevertheless extraordinarily difficult. Second, it's entirely conceivable that even if, in some respects, America or the 13 colonies had been regained by the British, either by negotiation that there hadn't been a war, or by war during that period, it's inconceivable, in my view, that the empire would have remained dynamic and strong in the 13 colonies. Because I think if the Americans had not broken away in the 1770s and 1780s, they'd have broken away in the 1790s and 1800s, when Britain was up against revolutionary France and Napoleon. So I don't think it is likely that the British could have won and could have held on to North America. And this, of course, reminds us of a wider importance of the American War of Independence. First, that the American War of Independence is the first of a series of revolutions in which European control collapses in most of the New World south of Canada. The next big one is the Haiti Revolution in Saint-Dominique against the French in the 1790s, creating the first state, first revolutionary independent black state in the world. And then, of course, the collapse of the Spanish and Portuguese empires in Latin America. So that by 1825, European control south of Canada only existed in a very few places on the mainland, principally in the Guianas, very few places. And this is a major shift in world history. What it means is that societies largely, although obviously not completely, but societies largely created by people of European origins, benefiting from, as it were, the cultural and political elements they received from Europe, but also benefiting from the ability to break free and become answerable to their own societies, their own politics, their own talents. These societies created a new world order in which the new world was fundamentally different politically to the old world. In the old world, you see the spread of European colonial empires in the 19th century, in Africa, in Asia, in Oceania, but you do not see that pattern in the new world. And when there are attempts to revive it, the French in Mexico in the 1860s, they go dramatically wrong. And this is of very great significance. It's very great significance within the history of the United States because it means that it's fundamentally up to Americans to remold their own geopolitics and their own country. So episodes such as, for example, the foundation of the Mormon settlements in Utah, episodes such as the American state expanding against Mexico, were largely taking place without any or very little role of the European powers. This, I think, is in tremendous significance for world history. And I don't think you can really undo the counterfactual and say, was it possible to maintain the colonial presence in the New World? And if so, what would have happened? Funnily enough, from the British point of view, and John, when he introduced me, referred to Yorktown, and I suppose a number of people here must have thought, well, it's rather odd for a British person coming along to say, could it have happened? Funnily enough, from the British perspective, you never get people in any way regretting what happened in terms of American independence. And I suspect there are two main reasons for that. First reason is that if the British want to look at unfortunate episodes in their own history, there is no shortage of episodes to look at in the last 60 years. So one hardly needs to go back to the 18th century. I mean, the most humiliating and disastrous defeat for the British Empire was not Yorktown, but it was the loss of Singapore to the Japanese in 1941, which really destroyed the logic, 1941, 1942, which really destroyed the logic of the British Empire in Asia. But there is a second point, and the second point is a simple one, that in a way, the terms by which America became a free state were ones which were difficult in the short term, and of course Britain and the American state was to fight another war between 1812 and 1815. There was not a period of necessarily of always close relationships. But in the long term, what was important to the British is that America, when it became independent, did not then spend its time intervening in the politics of the old world on the French side against Britain. The British benefited enormously in their wars against revolutionary France and Napoleon between 1793 and 1815 by the fact that most of that time the Americans did not fight them. Secondly, past 1815, Britain and America has never fought a war. Now, for those of you interested in the rise and fall of empires, you will know that that is unusual. Usually the rising empire fights the declining empire. But the British are extremely fortunate that America was the state that became the great power in the 19th century, that many Americans were willing to fight and many to give their lives in World Wars I and II against cruel tyrannies, which were equally our enemies as America's enemy. And we are very, very fortunate that in the end we lost the War of Independence and on the terms in which we did lose it. Thank you very much.